It's May 8th, 2014, and you're listening to a special episode of Night Your Beard Free to Play, a sideburn edition, where we interview dudes and talk about dudes who make video games and whatnot. My name is Brian Belita, and tonight I'm recording from my brother's satellite office in Rockville because my son is in like the room right next door to me, and it wouldn't be very good conversation if I was in my room whispering, talking. So I'm also joined by Dave Owen.
Hello.
Is it your son in the room next door to you?
No, he's not.
No,
awesome. We're all good. No whispers.
And tonight we're very happy to be talking to Ian Stalker, a.k.a. The Magical Time Bean.
Hey, how's it going?
Ian Stalker, of course, just put out Escape Goat 2, which is super cool. We talked about it on the podcast a couple episodes ago, which, interestingly enough, was published by... Is it published by Double Fine?
That's correct.
Okay, cool. Which is really cool because I know one day I saw Tim Schafer tweet a video, and there he was with you talking about Escape Goat, and in typical crazy Tim Schafer fashion. So that's really cool. I mean, how much, like, because obviously you put out Escape Goat 1 on what platforms? That was on XBLA and then PC later. Anything else?
No, started on Xbox Live Indie Games, came to PC, was ported to Mac and Linux. And that's basically it for Escape Goat 1.
That's cool. And then so I mean, how much more of a help was having Tim Schafer and Double Fine? I mean, like, what kind of all stuff did they do for you? Because that's kind of a really interesting thing that at least later on I'd like to see what kind of more stuff Tim Schafer and Double Fine get into.
Yeah, it was a very surreal turn of events, basically, that led to the publishing deal. And it didn't happen until the 11th hour. It wasn't like a typical publishing thing where it's you get funding or support throughout the project. This was basically like the game was done. I was showing it at media events, but Tim Schafer had played it because we were, you know, kind of finishing the game down the hall from their office, and we invited the Double Fine guys down for multiplayer games and beers a few times. And so it ended up being like he played the game and I heard through the grapevine that he liked it. And then I heard that they were going to get into publishing and they wanted to publish it. So I basically could not turn down that offer. We kind of just hammered out some details of, I don't know, can you guys hear the train? I'm right next
to
the train.
We can't. No, that's fine. My son loves trains.
Just some flavor for the interview.
It's getting
a little louder.
No, this is you in your office doing this right now. You're just, I mean, obviously you do some audio design stuff. But anyway, sorry, go on.
Yes, in the office in Berkeley, California. it came about 1 week before launch. And we launched on March 24th, so it was GDC week. We decided to launch the Monday after GDC. And so on top of attending GDC and all of that madness, there was like putting together the publishing deal and figuring out what sort of stuff they could help out with in terms of publicity. So, yeah, it started with the video, which was like written, shot, edited, and released in the matter of like 4 days over the weekend.
Oh, man, that's great.
Yeah, I just continued with them, you know, setting up interviews and media type stuff. And I don't know, organizing stuff that like they have way more experience with, like coupon exchanges for their games. So people who bought stacking got a 20% right. off coupon, that sort of thing.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a really neat thing that's been, I think, is that how I bought Escape Code? No, I got a coupon. I'm always get really confused when I log into Steam and I see, you know, you have a new item in your inventory, and I was like, oh, I wonder what it could be, and it's a, you know, a discount for something. I think I have like 8 no, I'm blanking on the name of the egg game with the chicken that walks around. It's a puzzle platformer game.
Oh, Tokitori.
I have like 8 Tokitori 2.
Me too.
Coupons or something like that. But no, but that's really a good idea. I mean, I guess it was a big help. Do you get any sort of idea of like if more people bought it, you know, with a coupon or at a sale price than at like full price? I mean, is that kind of data that you get?
I don't have access to what what percentage was coupons or at what price. I get like total units and I get total revenue per day. It's pretty cool of Steam to show all that stuff. But I'm not really sure. However, I know the coupons made a huge impact because I know the days that they dropped, it was like the day of launch. And then about 1 week later, another batch went and it was just like another huge spike once the second batch went out.
Okay. So it wasn't right at launch. That's interesting. Well, that's really cool then. Yeah. I guess, I mean, that's sort of the modern day. It's not really a sale. It's just how things are bought now. Like, you know, people put stuff out and then you discount it and then things get bought a lot of, and that kind of happens everywhere. You know, there are entire things like, you know, if you play any games on iOS on an iPhone, you know, there's App Shopper where you can just put an item on watch and then you buy it when it drops in price, or if, you know, you get a coupon. So it's sort of, I don't know, it's kind of an interesting thing that's just how games are bought these days. People buy them when they're on sale, and things go on sale all the time.
Yeah.
But anyways, no, just keep your price up there, all right? You just keep that price way up there.
And well worth it.
Well, yeah, exactly.
It's well worth it.
Yeah.
Well, I have to wait 2 months in between sales anyway. So, you know, it won't be until June or so that I could even drop the price if I wanted on Steam.
Is that something like enforced by Steam rules or?
Well, I mean, they could totally override it because they can do whatever they want. But the sales that you can set up, like, it's kind of a new thing, allowing the publisher to set, like, I want to do a sale of this much for this amount of time. And those ones that you can invoke yourselves or you can invoke yourself are controlled. Like, you can't do them whenever you want.
Right. Huh. I had no idea. Maybe I should just make a game, just at least try to, and publish it on Steam, or at least, again, try to, so I can be familiar with all this stuff about, you know, publishing games on Steam.
You make it sound so easy.
Yeah, no, I'll just make a game. Right. I mean,
just like that, Ian, right? You just make a game and just publish it on Steam, and it's just, you know, just like that.
Totally worth it to go through that just to figure out what it's like to, you know, use the Steam dashboard.
It's a part of Steam I'll never see, or maybe never see. I can't say that as of right now. I'm only 30, so there's still time. I could learn. I'm delving into board game design at the moment, so video games might be a different beast for now. So, yeah, I know Dave outlined some brief things, but I hope we kind of span out of that as well, and we can talk about whatever. If there's something you want to talk about, you can bring it up, and we'll do that.
Yeah, you know, we just want to make sure to hit the important stuff. You know, like, we want you to make sure that you talk about your game, and we want to get those few little questions in that we have, you know, curiosities. But, you know, appreciate you kind of pulling back the veil on Steam a little bit. And, you know, I've followed you for a long time, since the Soulcaster days. And yeah. And, you know, I noticed that's something that you do pretty regularly. I mean, on your site, magicaltimebean.com, for anyone who wants to head over there, you're very forward and very honest about the process of pushing these games through, making them, selling them, even, you know, going as far as to give, you know, figures on what you've made off the games, where the profits are coming from, you know, where the splits, what they look like from bundles. I mean, is that something that you feel maybe that you, I guess I want to get to the heart of the motivation of that. Is that just to get information out there, or is that to help other indies or demystify the process? And what's the motivation behind being so forward and so sharing?
Yeah, I'm definitely not the only indie that does that. Like, there are a lot of indies across the entire spectrum of, like, success or riches or whatever who totally share hard figures. I think it's a combination of I do like to kind of show the behind-the-scenes stuff, and I know there are people who like to read about that. And so, in a sense, it's kind of like publicity, so there's a little bit of an ulterior motive there. It's one of the ways that indies can actually get an audience competing against, like, AAA companies with multi-million dollar marketing budgets. Right. Is we can actually kind of be an interesting story sometimes.
Right, because AAA studios with multi-million budgets don't put out, you know, posts saying, oh, we just dropped, you know, $1 million on this 30-second TV ad.
Yeah, they're not really allowed to. Like, for some reason, nobody at the company wants to do that. They're very secretive. They probably have their reasons.
Yeah.
But yeah, we, you know, indies typically are not secretive. I have had to pull back just a little bit because Like Valve is not very secretive, but they have a few things. Like they don't want people giving out specific sales numbers for their games from Steam. They're fine with like aggregate sales numbers for PC across all the distributors. And you can kind of infer that 90% of them came from Steam, if not more. So they'll give you some sense.
Right.
But they probably just don't want people like aggregating, you know, building this database to pinpoint exactly how much each game is selling, that sort of thing.
Got it. So I have a question. So let's say somebody buys Escape Go 2 this goes for anything that maybe you can claim on Steam, but if they buy something on Humble and then, you know, redeem the key on Steam, I assume that doesn't count as a, like Steam doesn't calculate those products if somebody's playing it in Steam.
That's called an activation rather than a sale. So yeah, it does track those.
That makes sense. Okay. Well, cool. This is all really interesting stuff. I mean, it's stuff that I've never really thought about. So I'm glad you are kind of making these posts like that and kind of peeling back the veil for us a little bit. And I might have to go back and read some of your previous stuff on your blog, cuz I, unlike Dave, I have not been following you for very long. in the most non-creepy way possible. But what I really found in a recent post that you made about how you organize projects as an indie developer, which is the exact title of the post, is that you your first ever paid gig was doing music and sound for the Game Boy Color Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets game.
Yeah. Yeah, that was my career before going in. Like, I guess all indies had this thing that we left behind to go on this journey, and that was the thing that I used to do was contract soundtracks for games.
Yeah, well, and then because I know you did the soundtrack for Escape Go 1 and 2. Oh no, sorry, Disaster. I guess Disaster Piece helped out, right?
Yeah, he did the final stage song, which coincides with the Bone Dragon creature.
Right, the Bone Dragon. Because I finally finished up Escape Goat 1 today, and then kind of dipped my toes in the all intensive purposes levels a little bit. But so I beat it, and I mean I had known that you had a hand in the soundtrack, which is superb, by the way. It's really really good. It's so good.
Thank you.
And the scene that you kind of started off doing music and sound effects. I guess made that click in my head for kind of how that started together. When you started, I don't know. I mean, how old were you when you worked on the Harry Potter game for Game Boy Color?
Let me see. So that was 2002. So I was like 24 or so, 23.
Okay. And
everybody's doing the math now. How old are you?
That's right. Yeah. I'm sorry. I've made you reveal your age. So when did Soulcaster come out? I'm trying to do the timeline here. I mean, had you kind of delved into game creation at that point when you were doing sound stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I had little projects that I would start and work really intently on, and be really gung ho for like 2 weeks and work 12-hour days and then burn out and never touch it again. I did that like 3 or 4 times.
Yeah,
And then the different thing that I did, it was in 2008, I think. I just had some free time because a couple of music contracts were canceled. Like 2008 was kind of an interesting time with the world economy, as we all remember.
Yeah.
And I just kind of went to the coffee shop and I'm like, I'm going to put in 2 hours today and that's it. Like after 2 hours, I'm going to stop. And I just throttled my time and slowly creeped up to be about like 2 to 5 hours per day I would work just on what became Soulcaster.
Cool.
And that was really the key, like just kind of in a very energy conservation type of mode. And doing that for the first time was like, that was the difference between me completing the project and not completing it.
Got it. That's neat. So how did you kind of get your start with, as far as kind of, I guess, sound design and music composing?
I started writing music on the computer when I was a teenager. There are these, there's a few different ways to make music with the computer, and one of them is called tracking. And that goes back to like, it has its roots in the Amiga days. And I had never had an Amiga, but they did have trackers for DOS. And I basically learned to compose music by messing around with these. What was really cool is you could get the tracker files. They're called mods. And yeah. they contained like the note data, but also the sample data. So you could actually like have your own custom samples, like voice or, you know, drums or loops or whatever, sound effects built into the song. And because the note data was all visible in there, it wasn't like rendered out the way an MP3 is. You could just inspect the song, anyone's song. So you'd download the songs, listen to them, and then see how they put everything together. Right. One track at a time. So analyzing those is how I learned to write music, just gradually over many years.
No, wow. there's that. Oh, no, go on, Dave.
So I was just going to say I've actually very recently been playing around with the FAMI tracker.
Oh, really?
The NES tracker. And I've been doing that same kind of thing. I've just been sitting there staring at, like, you know, Kraid's theme. Like, okay, that's what that looks like in the actual notes. You know, and just going over that stuff in my mind. Not that I necessarily have any aspirations for, you know, creating music, but just discovered it one day and thought, this is amazing. Like, this is great. And yeah, if like 14-year-old me had found that, I would probably be making music today.
Yeah, I've always kind of dabbled in a little bit. I remember playing around with, I think Windows 3.1 had like a built-in drum machine. And I like, you know, and it's just, you know, kind of the grid of the sequencer, and you know, you can put the little, you know, the little blocks in where you want, you know, a certain beat to be made. I remember messing around with that. And then one of my friends turned me on to Fruity Loops. I must have been in like 2000 or something like that. Because I know, and I don't know if you did use that at all, Ian.
I did briefly try Fruity Loops, and then it became like FL Studio eventually, something
right,
like that.
Right, yeah. And then I got an iPhone in, I don't know, like 2008 or something like that, a smartphone. I grabbed a program called Nanoloop, and I guess that it has like a Game Boy version. Like you can buy like a cart for it or something, but he managed to also make an iOS version. So it's something I've always kind of dabbled in, and like I just find it really interesting. But then I realized like there's all this other stuff I want to, you know, try to do and get sidetracked. So I find it really amazing when somebody's able to kind of pick that up and kind of stick with that and make something as complex as, say, the Escape Goat or the Escape Goat 2 soundtrack, because they're really, really complex soundtracks. And they fit so well. I mean, with kind of the gothic, the stained glass look, and the music is just, it's just perfect. I really, really like it. I think I grabbed it. I'm pretty sure I bought it.
Well, good on you for your praise.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, no.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, how about, you know, I listen to your music and I hear, you know, I'm 35, so, you know, we're up there in the same range. Yeah. I hear a lot of influences from, you know, groups that I listened to when I was younger, maybe even some groups that came before me, before my time. But I don't know about influences, but I'll put this out there, and I don't know if it's on point or off point or not, but I hear a little bit of Tangerine Dream.
Oh, yeah. Maybe they were one of my favorite groups when I was in high school. Like Tangerine Dream and Orbital, I had more CDs of theirs than anyone else. You know. So, yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
I love that. I love that back. Like that was the claim. Like if you were like, I have more tapes than you of this band. I'm a bigger fan. Man, Dave, I had no idea you had an audiophile's ear there. Good on you.
Well, you know, Tangerine Dream is pretty unique sound from history, but yeah, a lot of the melodies and the feel that I get from a lot of music, it takes me back to that kind of stuff. And yeah, like Brian said, I mean, you know, I can't praise it enough. I sit and listen to the Escape Goat 1 soundtrack on loop when I'm just doing, you know, mundane work just to keep everything flowing.
That is really cool. Like that's, you know, that's what I intended when I wrote the music. I really wanted stuff people would want to listen to outside of the game. That's what I did a lot of. I did make cassette tapes of Super Nintendo soundtracks because it was like before you could really get them any other way. So I had like Lost Vikings and Chrono Trigger tapes and stuff like that. Eventually I discovered you could order these things from Japan. They were like $50 to get like a two CD soundtrack. But
right.
That's where all of my money went.
That's really so what kind of was it? I mean, was it the music that maybe you were kind of experimenting with this sort of the style that you used in Escape Goat that led you towards kind of making it, you know, the whole kind of gothic stained glass, you know, the typeface, everything being so kind of stylistically committed in that direction. And it's a game about a goat. I mean, where did that kind of decision to make the game in that sort of setting come from?
Yeah, you totally hit the nail on the head. Like,
was the music first?
Kind of. So the story of the theming of a scapegoat is I was making kind of just an unthemed blank slate of a side view platformer puzzle-ish game. And a couple months in, there was a discussion about the, you know, amongst my friends about the best misused English phrases. And a scapegoat was like one of the top ones. And so I'm like, that's the title for my game. That's the perfect title for a game. And it's going to be about a goat who's escaping. And so the character was down, but I also, you know, in listening to a lot of video game music, I came across the Castlevania Curse of Darkness soundtrack, and there's a song called Abandoned Castle, which you guys should all check out at some point. That song had exactly the tone that I was looking for in terms of energy and speed and seriousness. And yeah, being a Castlevania song, it was very gothic and serious, but, you know, a very like hard rock type of song as well. And so I'm like, this is going to be perfect because I want this game where the title is like really goofy, but as soon as you get past the title, it's just dead serious, like everything right. about it.
Like there are reapers that shoot flame balls at you. That's yes. serious, if you ask
yes.
me.
Yeah, it is not a farming game.
No, those are not farming sites. I will say that much. But that's really cool. It's really interesting to see how one thing led to another. I mean, I usually don't associate games as kind of maybe a soundtrack or a sound or a song guiding kind of the development of it otherwise. So that's really, really cool, I think.
Yeah, I tend to actually find like others, like songs from other games, and before I have a soundtrack for a game that I'm working on, I'll toss in various songs to see how it changes the mood and see kind of what speed is the right speed. And actually, yeah. One of the temp tracks in the beta for Escape Goat 2 was a Journey song called Separate Ways, Worlds Apart. It has an amazing music video I discovered when I looked it up on YouTube.
Oh man, I'm gonna have to look that up now.
Yes.
For some reason now, there's almost no relation, but all I have in my head right now, maybe it's because I watched it the other day, is Johnny Five from Short Circuit to Bonnie Tyler's In Need of a Hero.
Okay.
if you, I don't know, if you watch the Short Circuit movies. But he's all like ganged out, and he's you know, he's got sparks flying everywhere, and he's, I don't know, maybe it's because he's going on a journey. I don't know. Anyway, so I just want to talk about Johnny Five whenever I get the chance.
So, I've got to check that out now.
Yeah, it's really good. Well, I'll have to link it to you at the break or something. So while we're talking about the music, so how did Disaster Piece get involved with making a track for Escape Goat 2?
Part of the advantage of living in the San Francisco Bay Area is that it's just like a nexus of game development, especially indie game development. And
I'm so jealous.
Yeah. Rich actually lives like a couple miles from where I'm recording this right now. And so we're practically neighbors, and, you know, I'll see him at meetups and stuff like that. So yeah, it was kind of the same way that I found Randy to do the art. It was just through proximity and making friends and feel like, hey, how would you like to do a track for the game? Right. And he had already played it a lot. He, he liked the game, and I knew that he would deliver on that. So I just sent him some drafts of stuff that I'd been working on so he could get a feel for the overall sound of the game. I'm just like, do whatever you want, whatever you think would be good. And nice. What you hear is just, that's what he turned in. There were no revisions. He just nailed it on the first try.
Oh, man.
I love that. I love that track. It would fit perfectly right into the soundtrack of The Labyrinth. Mm. It's got a very sort of that era David Bowie kind of feel to, you know, at least to me. I don't, you know, I may be imagining that, but
no, I would agree.
I had to stop for a minute and make sure that, you know, my my MP3 player hadn't looped over, you know, Winamp hadn't looped over to the Labyrinth soundtrack.
Yeah.
The first time I heard it. But yeah, that's, you know, that ability to collaborate like that. I mean, you know, you're a one-man show up until Scapegoat 2. I mean, what was that like bringing in Randy? For those of you who don't know, Randy O'Connor did the art for Waking Mars.
Yeah.
Several other games.
Oh, man. I saw that in my Steam account the other day, and I still have to play it.
Yeah, you should. It's well, apart from being beautiful, it's a good game. But what was that like for you? I mean, a guy who is kind of the show, you know, opening up to other people being involved.
The big show.
So it's really cool. I think it went really smoothly. Like, I approached it kind of with a lot of fear because, you know, people I worked with were also friends, and I didn't want to have it be this drama situation that would, like, jeopardize friendships. So we were very cautious about things and made sure we, you know, we did a lot of groundwork up front about what type of agreement this would be. And, you know, I think just being very cautious helped a lot. I learned early on, or just kind of stumbled upon, a pretty good directing technique, which works great if you're working in the same room with someone, which is just to not do any direction. When Randy would submit like a new sprite sheet or something, and then he just turned to me and say like, okay, it's on Dropbox. Then I'd toss it in the game. We'd rebuild it. Then I could play a level showing, you know, like the new temple sprite sheet. And like, I usually would not have to say anything. If there was something not quite right about it, he would totally catch it, and I wouldn't have to become the bad guy by telling him about it.
Right, right.
If it was over email, I would have to be like, yeah, this one tile is just like not fitting with the rest of them or something like that. But 9 times out of 10, if there was something that needed to be changed, like, he would do it. There were a few things we butted heads about, but not that many things.
See, I kind of, that's kind of the quietly menacing way. Like, let's say I was a boss or something, and somebody came up to me and was like, hey, so what do you think? And I just stand there silent. And then they start having a conversation with themselves and solve all the problems without me having to do anything. They're kind of like, oh, God, no? Okay. All right. No, maybe I did that. Okay. All right. I'll go back and I'll fix it. And I just haven't said anything. So it's probably a good directorial style. I'll have to try it out if I'm ever in that position.
Yeah, Randy did learn to read me pretty well when he'd show me something for, like, my opinion on it, you know, once it's done. Like, it was to where he wanted it to be, but he wanted, like, my take on it. He could tell if I would immediately say that's the coolest thing I've ever seen, like, that totally rocks, then he would know it's good. If I would hesitate even slightly, then no matter what compliment I gave him, you know, trying to, you know, say, you know, start with the good points, but then point out the bad points, he knew that it was, like, not what I was looking for.
Right, right. Yeah, and he's been all over the place. I mean, I feel like his portfolio has been accelerating. I feel like every other week I see maybe he's doing a new soundtrack for something or other, which is great for him. I mean, it's not like they're all the same music. They're all very stylistically different. I mean, from like Bit Trip Runner to Fez, Crunch, even Puzzle Agent. So it's neat that you got to work with him, because he's an artist that I really, really enjoy.
Yeah, totally.
Talking back about Disaster Piece now.
Yes.
Or just no, Journey.
Connecting the threads. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I was back on Bonnie Tyler.
Johnny Five.
input. Sorry, that's another short circuit thing. I mean, obviously it was a huge graphical update in Scapegoat 2, which is gorgeous, by the way. Again, another super, it's just a good game. If you haven't bought Scapegoat 2, just go buy Scapegoat 2. You won't regret it, because it's really pretty. I just kind of think back to the original Free Spelunky and the new Spelunky, and it's kind of been neat seeing games that are mechanically the same, and like good mechanics. I mean, and not in the same a bad way, but just updated to be just super pretty. I mean, obviously he kind of stuck to the style of Scapegoat 1. Were there assets that didn't, I mean, did you want to span outwards from the style of Scapegoat 1 at all?
Yeah, a little bit. So, we did kind of rein things in. There were some things we thought about doing, and it kind of became clear that this was going to become like a content, you know, hog, like maybe having full screen vistas or panoramic backgrounds, like matte paintings to go along with some of the levels. It would have been kind of cool to have unique full screen art, but it also would have been a ton of work. So we really stuck to the tile-based layout. We added a lot more tiles. So like the tile sheets per zone are probably double in size. There's a lot more variance in decorative tiles. The lighting, the dynamic lighting is probably just the most dramatic change in terms of like from a Scapegoat 1 to 2. Aside from it being four times the resolution, it is the lighting also makes a big difference. I never played original Spelunky. I've seen screenshots of it. So I've only played new Spelunky. So I don't really know about that graphical upgrade. But when when Randy and I were talking about how to change the visuals, I really just wanted it to become his own envisioning of the Escape Goat world. I didn't want him to take the like all the assets from the first game and just remake them in a higher resolution.
Yeah.
So he came up with his own look for the Reapers and the goat and all the tile sets, all the zones were his idea. I didn't think of a single concept for them. So, you know, the temple, the forest, like all that stuff was, so he's like the art director as well.
Excellent. Yeah. I really love the new Reapers, the way they look, but I have to admit, you know, I'm a Soulcaster fan. So, you know, those Reapers, those blue Reapers have been with us so long.
I kind of
lamented their passing, but I really like the new design too.
I looked back at some Soulcaster stuff and I was like, oh, hey, it's the Reaper.
Yep.
Yeah.
Placeholder art sometimes finds its way into the final game.
It works. I mean, it's the exact thing that's needed for that. So, so obviously the game is called Escape Goat. So what, sheep? Why sheep?
That's a really good question. I don't.
I mean, if there's no answer, that's totally fine. I mean, if the answer is because sheep, that's completely fine.
Yeah, I think I wanted to have just animals, and you know, I liked animals, and like I thought it would be really cool to have this game that was very serious and bleak, but it was populated by farm animals. Yeah. So I think that's where the sheep came from.
I do want to point out that the second image on a Google image search for Ian Stalker is you with a baby goat.
Yes. Had I known when that image was taken, when that picture was taken, that would become like, I don't know, I think Polygon put that up as like the file photo. For, yeah.
Oh, man. That's pretty good. I'm now imagining Randy doing like a stained glass illustration of that picture of you with a goat. You know, kind of maybe the architect of the tower or something.
Maybe I should have that actually made into stained glass I get to that level.
You probably should. Keep us updated if that's a thing that you do. Because we would like to know and break it or something. I don't know. Not break it. I mean like the exclusive, you know.
Break the news, not the
break
glass.
Break the news. No, don't. I would not want to break that at all. That'd be bad luck. That'd be really bad luck. And I want to go back real quick to you saying that, you know, scapegoat and kind of a saying that is gone wrong. And it's only now I feel like a real dumbass because when I did finish up later and then I was like, all intensive purposes, like, oh, you know, I used to make that mistake. I wonder why. It's got to be a purposeful joke. Meanwhile, I'm playing a game called Scapegoat and my brain just didn't put two and together until just now. And I feel really dumb for just kind of being like, oh, they called it all intensive purposes. Cause that's, I'm guilty of that one. I was guilty of that one for a really long time. Like until I was 20, long time.
Really obnoxious thing with the green light page for Escape Goat 1, if you want to check it out, where I picked like 20 of those misused phrases. They're actually called egg corns, like E-G-G-C-O-R-N-S. And
there's a name for them?
There's a name for that. My absolute all-time favorite,
egg corn,
which I didn't use on the green light page, but... is a bowl in a china shop, B-O-W-L.
A bowl in a
because it just takes on this all new meaning, with slight change in pronunciation.
I just want a podcast about egg corns now, a new leash on life. That's so good. Oh, cold slaw. Oh my gosh. All right. No, I have to stop. I can't. I cannot continue to read these because I'm just going to get sucked into this. That's really cool. Well, that's. I'm glad you did that. I'll have to pull up the Steam Greenlight page at some point. And if it's still there, do the Greenlight pages stay up after something gets approved?
They do. There's a little pop-up that says, like, why are you here? Go to the community page. But you can close that and still see the Greenlight page.
Right. I guess because it'll say, like, you know, this has been approved or whatever. So, awesome. Right. Well, I'm going to recommend that we take is there a break Eggcorn? Maybe an Eggcorn about breaks? Nope. I got nothing. There are no Eggcorns about break. So we're just going to take a break. One question I always say I'm going to ask, but usually end up never, is I like asking people what their ringtones are, because I find it's usually something that, you know, you set it up. It's something that you're going to get, and maybe you kind of secretly hope somebody else might get who hears it in public. Do you have, I mean, is this a question I should ask you, or do you just have a boring ringtone?
There's a story behind it. I mean, I just have the default iPhone ringtone because I never got around to, it's like one of these things. It's just, it's part of the reason why, I moved 6 weeks ago, but there's still boxes in the closet that I really should go through. But, after, you know, a hard day of indieing, I start really feel like it. So yeah, that's kind of the story behind it. It's one of those many neglected things.
Right, neglect. It's just I should do this, but I'll do it later. I can deal with the iPhone ringtone first. So wait,
yeah,
so
it's not terrible.
You moved 6 weeks ago, you said, right?
Yeah.
When did Scapegoat 2 drop?
6 weeks ago.
Okay, that was probably
perfect
fun.
Timing.
That was probably fun for you.
Yeah, it came out on the 24th. Our move date was the 27th. We did have until the 1st to move stuff over. It was just across town, so it wasn't like across the state or something.
Yeah.
But didn't really work out in terms of timing, so it was a very, very memorable time.
Yeah. Oh man, what is, I have to ask, what is in the Magical Time Bean logo? It looks like a fox or a wolf. I see the Reaper, and then is that a snail on the bottom left?
So that's actually from the Soulcaster sprites. Those are like the spawner logos for when, like, those little black and white flashing things that the monsters spawn out of.
I have just colored in Soulcaster, so I will need to do that.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, when everybody's ready, we can.
Yeah, I don't know. That was kind of, we might
refreshed or
refreshed. We might cut in some of that conversation or something.
Sure.
But yeah, we can come back for Real Reels now and actually maybe talk about that a bit more because I'm curious about the history of Soulcaster. All right, cool. We're back with Ian Stocker, the creator of Escape Go 2. But you already knew that. I mean, I doubt you came into this podcast in the middle of it, so hopefully you already knew that. So, Ian, one of your earlier games, or maybe first games, was Soulcaster.
Yeah, first indie game.
First indie game, Soulcaster.
Yes, I made this in, like, 2008 in XNA, and it came out on Xbox Live Indie Games.
Well, for those who don't know, maybe haven't played Soulcaster, you play as a wizard who has the ability to summon heroes to aid him. There's a knight who can block and absorb damage. There's an archer who has great range damage, and a thief guy who throws Molotov cocktails.
You seem confused about the identity of this thief guy.
He's a rogue of some sort. He's, yeah.
Yeah, he's a hooded figure. Firebombs,
throws things at people. Yeah, and it's really, it trends more towards a puzzle game than anything else. It looks like Gauntlet, but plays like a strategic tower defense-y sort of, you know, puzzle game, really.
So it's like turn-based.
Not really turn-based, no.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's real time.
Real time. You place down your kind of your defense guys, and then it gets real, and stuff comes, and sometimes it goes well, and sometimes it doesn't. And each hero has his own powers, and it's all about using them in strategic ways to defend your wizard, who's essentially helpless.
Yeah, it's like a tower defense game where you play as the cursor. Like the wizard's kind of the cursor because that's where you can place down these summons. They don't move, so they operate a little bit like towers. The monsters will spawn out of, you know, corners and, you know, off screen and doorways and stuff like that. And they path to they definitely want to path to the wizard, to you, to kill you, but they'll also take out the summons if they encounter them. So you'll want to, like, if there's a corridor, you want to stick the knight right there to hold the line. But it's actually even better to have them, like, kind of just outside the door so that he engages one of the monsters and leaves a shot for the archer to, like, do some damage to the monster while he's holding the line. So it's all about placement in real time. A little bit of, I don't know, Final Fantasy Tactics, but not as complex. Just very fast-paced dungeon crawling.
Yeah, so I only bring this up because it was a recent thing, and I usually hate doing this. I usually hate being the guy that's like, oh, so it's like this, it's like the Dark Souls of this. I hate that everything. We need to, I think Imran, one of the other Nitrobeer guys, said we need to put a moratorium on comparing things to Dark Souls because everything's to do. But I only bring this up because one of the recently successful Kickstarters was Julian Gollop's Chaos Reborn, and so it sounds to me, I mean, just from the standpoint of a wizard summoning things and sort of, you know, maybe a grid-based thing, like a live-action Chaos, which to me is like a cool thing. And I'm sorry I didn't play this earlier, but I'm really excited to play it at this point now. I mean, did you play Chaos? Or, I mean, have you been following Chaos Reborn at all? Is that the kind of game that you are interested in?
I'd never heard of it, but I'm going to look it up right now.
Yeah, you should do that. It's really cool. I mean, Chaos Reborn, that one is turn based. Obviously, it's not live action, and you are a wizard, and you summon minions to help you, and you have other spells at your disposal. But that's,
it's got like a hexagonal grid.
Yep.
And so this would be a similar type of experience. But I mean, from
the standpoint of wizard, but I mean, gameplay wise, obviously they're much different.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised there aren't more games where you're, like, you know, a helpless creature summoning things to do your bidding. I really like the concept of, like, kind of NPC versus NPC combat, where you indirectly affect things rather than directly attack stuff. That's kind of going to be the theme that I explore in this phase of my indie career, I think.
Right. Yeah, over the break, you mentioned that you were, I don't know if you've started or maybe you are going to start work on maybe another entry into the Soulcaster game, and that's cool. Can you tell us a little bit more about that maybe?
Yeah, so Soulcaster 3 was originally going to be what I worked on in 2013, but it kind of got put on ice while I made Escape Goat 2. I just kind of flipped a coin and determined I was going to work on Escape Goat 2. They both seemed like really good next steps me to do. And but now that that's done, I'm, you know, in addition to doing some support stuff and additional content for Escape Goat 2, I'm, you know, kind of part-time transitioning a little bit back into the Soulcaster world. So I've installed the renderer from Escape Goat 2 into the Soulcaster code base so we can have, like, the lighting effects and that sort of stuff. I've just got a stack of ideas for things I want to try.
Yeah, well, Escape Goat 2 had some really pretty lightning. So that's right there is perfect for a wizard. I'm just saying. So, just from when I initially looked at screenshots of Soulcaster, immediately into my mind came a lot of, but some tabletop games. Do you do much tabletop gaming, board games?
That's something I actually never got into, inexplicably. I also never played D&D, so I mean, I have to confess that my nerd cred is actually pretty.
That's fine. I mean, I've never. I don't think I maybe played like for a minute, like some D&D as a kid, maybe through my brother. But it's something I never really did. And it's only in, I don't know, maybe in like 2006 that I really started getting into tabletop gaming and board games more. Mm-hmm. And it's which is bad because, like, that was right when all me and my college friends, you know, graduated from college. And, you know, now, you know, we try to get together like once a month to play board games. But There's been a huge kind of resurgence of board games and digital board games. I hate saying that because it's like it's not like, there
you
are
video games.
Right, it's a video game with it's you know simply a strategy video game. So I hate saying that, but no, I was just curious because I guess I was seeing where there weren't some possible tabletop influences in Soulcaster, but you know it's real time, so that takes out a bit of it. Although there are some real time tabletop games.
It definitely. I mean, Soulcaster has that feel. I mean, I think you probably. I mean, apart from the fact that you know you can't necessarily shoot at things and whatnot. I mean, it really does have a bit of a feel of you know moving your pieces around, like you said, you're the cursor.
Yeah.
So you just kind of you're placing out your pieces and you're sort of setting up your strategy, and it does have the underpinnings there, even if it doesn't actually have a link back to any strategic tabletop games. You know.
Yeah.
It comes through.
Yeah,
and just in the sense that it's like you use the environment. You know, if you've got like a river or you know vantage point or something like that. So it's placement using the environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like some games of HeroQuest that I played as a kid.
Yeah, exactly. So I was just thinking about, I know this is completely off topic, but looking at Julian Gollop's Chaos Reborn and some other board games that I've played, like Heroescape, and I've never played Settlers of Catan, but more like turn-based games and like grid-based games, tile-based games need to use hexagons. Like most of them use squares. No, I'm not saying that you should for Soulcaster. You've got something worked out there. But I just like hexagons.
Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah, I mean, I think it's more flexible and it makes more sense because you know it's like you can do diagonals without it being on these corners.
Yeah.
Only thing with a game is like you're either dealing with like arrow keys or a D-pad, and those are designed for like four directions. I guess an analog stick could handle it pretty well, but like if you're doing it on a computer. I don't know. Maybe point and click for pathing might work.
Right. Right. Yeah, it can vary. So, but yeah, no, like I said, you should definitely get into some tabletop gaming. Cause it's really fun. It's one of my favorite things. And I see a lot more kind of crossover stuff going on and designers crossing over too. So off of kind of stuff that you have done, what kind of video games do you play when you're not making games? I mean, what kind of stuff have you been playing lately?
So I tend to not like sample a bunch of different games. I tend to just grab a couple games and then spend lots of time, in each of those games and just like overplay them. I've been playing a lot of Banished lately. That's been really fun.
Oh, man. I bought that for my brother for his birthday. It's like the really, 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 it's the Dark Souls of town building from what I understand.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Like everyone says Dark Souls is it's a way of saying like it has a challenge aspect to it or something. Maybe that's where we've come is if the game doesn't beat itself for you, it's the Dark Souls of X.
Right.
But it's, you know, you get a procedural world and then you just kind of got to survive in it. And I really like games where it's like you're given a situation and your knowledge of the game systems is like, you pitting your wits against the game and seeing if you can make it work given what hand you're played. So that's been a lot of fun. I played Dark Souls 2 all the way through.
What platform are you playing that on?
Xbox 360.
Okay. Okay, cool. Yeah. I've delved into that and I'm not as well versed as some of my friends, but, I'm glad Dark Souls 2 came out and the PC port is good because that's the only way that I was going to play it because like most of my gaming time now is on my computer after my wife and kid have gone to bed, and that's just I'm just at my computer late at night. That's just where I am. So I've been having fun delving into that. How far into it are you? I mean, there's no really good measure, but like what kind of area of Dark Souls 2 are you in right now?
Oh, I've actually beaten the game and done a little bit of New Game Plus with a friend with co-op just to kind of see what's going on in there.
Nice. That's pretty cool. And anything else past that? I mean, do you I mean, kind of handheld or even mobile gaming any at all?
Hmm. So I don't have a handheld system. I actually don't have a 3DS, which is like kind of nuts because I worked on so many DS games as a contractor. Right. Maybe that's part of the reason is it's like, you know, it equates to work for me.
Yeah, I hear that.
Yeah, on the phone, I don't know. I kind of fear certain mobile games. Like I got Letterpress maybe a year ago and had to uninstall it. Like I found myself like entranced where like I didn't know what was happening and an entire day passed and I was on the couch and I did not eat or anything. And
oh my gosh.
Like my wife came home and found me in this state and was like, yeah, okay, you're uninstalling that. You can play it for one more day.
Oh my gosh. I kind of it's funny. I don't know if you listen to the Idle Films podcast at all, but Chris Remo had a story similar to that with Threes.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And how he just had to uninstall because it would just absorb his entire life. So that's yeah.
That's why I didn't install Threes. Is I
yes.
I
stay away from Threes.
You knew it would happen.
Yeah.
Stay away from Threes. Yeah. It's a life eater.
Yeah. It is. I don't know. It's weird. I kind of go back and forth between having like I don't know. I guess like gaming ADD where I'm just playing like a bunch of stuff at one time and it's really bad. It's really really bad. But I try to stick to like one game at a time if it's like a single player game, you know, per platform, or not single player, but you know, a game that I can work through. Not like, you know, Counter-Strike Go is kind of just always there, you know, Spelunky is sort of just always there, but then you know, then I try to limit it to one game per platform that I'm playing until I'm done with that game. But now and again my gaming ADD flares up and I'm all over the place. I'm playing Escape Goat 1, Escape Goat 2 at the same time. I started playing Escape Goat 2 before Escape Goat 1. Which is really kind of neat to see the change before, you know, going back to Escape Goat 1. So, well, that's
It's even shocking for me when I go back to Escape Goat 1 and like, it takes me a moment to acclimate to the graphical change.
Yeah. And let's see how many years apart were Escape Goat 1 and 2?
Escape Goat 1 was finished in, the end of 2011 and then, came out on PC in 2012. So it was like a good, depending on how you slice it, year and a half, 2 years.
Okay, that's not that long. I mean, especially for such a huge visual overhaul to happen, and for it to be done so well.
when we first started, it was like, let's treat this like a game jam. We're just going to do a graphical retreatment. You know, just reskin the game. This will only take 3 months. Like
new puzzles.
Yeah. it's just a content thing, no new mechanics, whatever. But of course, like I decided I wanted to try making some new mechanics and we added this map system and it was just all hell broke loose and it was a year and a half.
Right. Yeah, I could see how that would very easily happen. I mean, obviously it's, you know, it's the age old, anything worth doing is worth doing well. So you kind of end up going overboard, which isn't bad. I'm glad you did. We're glad you did.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was kind of extended because of how people were responding to it. Once we got to GDC of last year, not this year, but like over a year ago, I was showing it to just some other devs and people were responding really well to it. And so I thought, maybe if I polish this up, it could actually like be a really good game. So yeah, the more people seem to like it in playtests and stuff like that, the more perfectionistic I got about it. And I took it to a greater degree of perfection than I normally take games. Like Soulcasters and the first Escape Goat were probably at like 85% satisfaction. And then this was closer to like 90% satisfaction, which is really last bad 5%
that it's really bad that you set a percentage and my brain immediately started. It's like, is he about to say something about a Metacritic score? He shouldn't worry about that.
No, it has nothing to do with Metacritic score. Just, you know, like if we can say 100% is takes infinity time and 99% satisfaction takes like 100 years, then,
right.
Yeah, it's kind of along that scale.
Now you don't have to answer this question because I know stuff like this can sometimes, you know, make people, oh, well, why didn't you include it? But were there any kind of new mechanics or, you know, puzzle blocks or anything that you maybe experimented with including in Escape Goat 2 that just really did not work at all?
Yeah, there were a couple. So one did not work. One worked too well. And so the one that did not work was the ghost block. And that was basically a, it was kind of like the Super Mario World exclamation blocks that can toggle on and off. And, but it was in real time. And there were these blocks that would toggle whether or not they existed in the world based on whether the mouse was out. So when you summon the mouse, the walls, you know, switch from being, you know, tangible to intangible. And so it opened up some really cool puzzles where you're, like, you know, having to make a jump and then summon the mouse, but keep the mouse alive, you know, because you need the bridge there. And
right. Well, so, I mean, we all know nobody likes escort missions, so.
Yeah, so parts of it were kind of an escort mission, but it was also, one person just told me it's like, doesn't fit with the rest of the game. Everything else in the game makes sense. Even the Reapers, like, even though they're like a fantasy creature, they kind of make sense. But the ghost blocks, like, they don't fit in the theme of like these mechanisms or machinery or ingredients or something. It was just too weird. So we took them out. It was also very, very hard for players to understand what was going on with them.
Right.
I would have levels just dedicated to like kind of forcing the player to see how they work. But in the end, it wasn't worth spending the levels, you know, on those. So we just ripped them out. The one that worked too well was the match three blocks. I actually made these at the TIG Jam, and it's a variation of the ice blocks that are colored, and when they are adjacent to each other in patterns of three, they evaporate, and sometimes there's keys inside of them. And
sometimes, where there are sometimes Reapers inside of them?
That is a great idea. I had not even thought about that, but I could do that.
Escape Goat 3 mechanic.
Yes. Well, so they're in there. The code, the engine supports them. And I started making levels with this and realized there was no place I could put them in the game. Like each zone, we've got 10 zones. Each one has a theme and kind of a signature gadget. And there was just no room left, even though we have 121 rooms in Escape Goat 2.
Yeah.
There was not going to be an entire zone that could be themed after this. And even just one zone couldn't explore these things fully enough. I actually put them into the Candy Escape Goat Saga free little Candy Jam game. And that was like as popular during playtesting as Escape Goat 2 itself. Like,
wow.
That blew my mind. So there's something about Match 3 that people just love. And
right. It's visceral.
Yeah. There's something just way down in the brain that responds to Match 3. So it would be cool to have like a DLC. Or level pack or something that just goes bonkers with all the things we can do with those match three blocks.
Oh man, I can't wait for your eggcorn about a match three block DLC.
I will have to
pick. Yeah, that would be really good.
Just the right one.
Yeah.
It'd be a diamond dozen.
Oh man. All right. You're good at this.
Yeah. So, you know, you were talking about the ghost blocks and the idea of like the time investment to kind of teach the player how they work and wasting the levels. You know, that's something that you in Escape Goat, at least you do quite a bit of, is the non-explicit teaching.
I mean,
you know, it says kind of like press A to jump and stuff like that. But, you know, you very often just set someone into a room and you just kind of say, oh, figure it out. And I really love that. I mean, is there any specific, you know, maybe any specific influence that you have that kind of pushed that forward, or is that just, you know, in your opinion, a good way to design games?
So around the time I was finishing up Escape Goat 1, Jonathan Blow tweeted out a link to a video by Egoraptor called Sequelitis, Mega Man X.
Mega Man.
Which everyone needs to watch, because it is still to this day my favorite video on game design, period. And it, you know, basically talks about how you shouldn't have text and you shouldn't interrupt the player to tell them how to play your game. You should just find ways to have them demonstrate to themselves what the game does. And so that was kind of like my guiding light for how I was going to make Escape Goat 2. And actually, when I went to port Escape Goat 1 to PC, I did a few tweaks to the levels, just a few balance changes. But one of the things I did was take out a few of the tablets that say, like, oh, you can push ice blocks by headbutting them. Like if you play the Xbox Live Indie Games version of Escape Goat, there's a message that says that in the first level where you see the ice blocks. But in the PC version in that level, there's no message, but instead where the player spawns, there's just an ice block that you need the headbutt in order to get out of a little enclosure that you're in. So it's like, you're going to do that naturally anyway, because you're stuck and you're going to want to headbutt stuff, and then you'll just see what happens.
Right. And, you know, probably having recently learned the headbutt technique, you figure it's going to be useful on everything you see.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the one interaction you have with the world directly. Right, so it's the thing you try on everything.
You don't have a huge move set, so it's very, very easy and inviting to experiment with the different things that you can do. So I really appreciate that kind of design. I don't think a scapegoat needed, you know, like an objective marker or a mission list or something like that.
I think, you know, for me, the most impressive one is the bone snake. Because at first I had no idea what to do with that thing when it first pops out in the last levels. And just slowly but surely started to understand, okay, that those, you know, waves radiating from its face, that looks in the direction that I move. And if I move it around here, it follows me, and then I can get it to go where I want. It's just that thing that makes you as a player feel clever, you know, even though, you know, you're not, you're stumbling upon exactly what you're supposed to be stumbling upon, but you feel clever. Like you feel like, oh, I figured that out. I beat that. I maybe I did something I wasn't supposed to do. Ooh, you know, but all along it's completely intended, but it feels really great as a player to get that feeling. So I always appreciate games that kind of give you that opportunity.
Yeah, even stuff where it's like unintended. There are tons of solutions to levels which were unintended that come out in playtesting. I usually leave them in unless it's something that like skips a thing that the player needs to learn about in order to solve future puzzles. Even if it's a really asinine shortcut, I'll totally leave that in for speedrunners or you know, just for people who think outside the box.
Yeah, I think we even brought that up when we were talking about a scapegoat. For free to play.
Yeah, a couple of the guys felt like they had broken it, and I just didn't say anything. I didn't want to say like, actually, that's exactly what you're supposed to do in that level.
Right.
But you know, like,
it's a red herring.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it's good when a player feels like, because I did this thing, I totally broke this level, but actually you completed it as intended. You know. But speaking of speedrunning.
Yeah.
What does it feel like to not be the fastest person to complete your own game?
Yeah, that's a good question. No, it's I knew that this was the case, and it's been this way.
Yeah.
Like, there are people who can beat all my games faster than I can at this point. There's some Soulcaster speedruns on YouTube, and people know the shortcuts. Even though I know a lot of the shortcuts in Escape Goat 1 and 2 from watching their videos, I cannot execute them very well. And yeah. Yeah, so I knew I didn't stand a chance. I did get 11th place in the speed race last month, which was, I think, respectable considering what I was up against.
Yeah, you were up against some pro guys, so yeah, I think that was a good place to finish. Yeah, I've actually watched a couple of developers sit and actually watch speedrunners, you know, in their Twitch channel speedrunning their game and just being, you know, mind blown that. That's how did you do that? How is that? How did I not see that, you know, in the design process? And I think the whole speedrunning thing, I mean, it's not something that I'm personally interested in doing, but I love that. Just back to, you know, the days of Quake Done Quick and stuff like that. Just the idea of completely taking the mechanics of a game and breaking them in such a way that just lets you speed right through it in ways never intended, but also in a way that's almost beautiful in some sense. But yeah, I love the speedrunners, and I thought that was a really great event there. And I'm glad that you actually participated, even if you did finish 11th.
Yeah, I've been a fan of speedrunning forever. Quake Done Quick,
You were about to say Speed Racer. Have you been a big Speed Racer fan too? No, I'm just
amazingly no. That's an anime I just never saw. No, there's also a Half-Life 2 Ravenholm Done Quick that was like so amazing and poetic. And I think that's what stuck with me and made me always kind of think of speed runners playing my games and how I could leave some shortcuts in there if they came up, you know, not patch everything out. And there was actually one thing, if you talk about breaking the game, there is a tactic in Escape Go 2 called boost jumping, where you can actually get an extra maybe 3/4 of a block in jump height that you're not supposed to get with like practically a single frame. It's a 1 or 2 frame timing thing with releasing and pressing jump again for the double jump at a particular point. This was discovered by one of the testers, Zach, who actually made All Intents and Purposes. He found this and linked me to a video of himself like beating some of the levels in just, you know, ridiculous ways. And I was going to patch it out because it was just such a big shortcut. And also because it, like, I couldn't do it. I sat there for 5 minutes and could not get it. And I was even in debug mode looking at the variables, like, how is it getting the extra boost there? And to this day, I only barely understand. But he begged me to not take that out. Like you said, this is the type of thing people are going to practice for hours to get, and speedrunners love this sort of thing. And he was totally right. In the race and, you know, the speedrunning community, they've just talked about how boost jumps are like what makes this a fun game to race.
You just answered my question. I was just about to ask you, I mean, with kind of the growth and expansion of speedrunning being a thing, I mean, obviously, like, games done quick, and it's kind of over the last couple of the years become just, it's just a thing that's kind of ingrained in video game culture. And I was going to ask if you did anything on purpose to kind of allow for speedrunners to do that kind of thing. But I guess it's kind of the thing that gets discovered, and then the developer, as you just said, decides not to patch out.
Yeah, that was one of the cases of just something that was, it was game breaking, but it was hard enough to, we got another train coming. it was hard enough to execute that I wasn't afraid of average players on their first time through finding all these shortcuts and bypassing important things.
Yeah. And what did you say it was called again? What's become the official name?
The official name is the boost jump, which boost jump. I didn't come up with. I also didn't come up with Henry, which is what they named the mouse. If you look at,
I was wondering about that. I saw somebody called him Henry, and I was like, I was wondering where they.
Yeah, if you see the forums on, like, you know, tactics and room, you know, strategies and paths, they say, yeah, you need to radapult Henry up to the top platform and. Or leave Henry in the
yes, radapult.
The radapult's another exploit that
so good.
I was aware of, and I left in. That's been in there since Escape Goat 1. You can try it. It's really easy to execute, actually. But if you hold up and press B to launch Henry, you know, that's like a pretty standard move. But if you do that at the same time that you start a dash, it gives that like horizontal velocity to Henry as well, so he can be flying across the screen.
Okay, I think I did that on one of the final levels of Escape Goat 1, the one where there's I guess fireballs being launched at you, and you have like 5 or 6 ice blocks that you can that kind of drop down, and you can headbutt, and they slide over blocking the fireballs. Mm-hmm. And then there's like a bunch of the buzzsaws. I think I did that because I dashed by that opening and tossed Henry up, and then he went and hit the switch to, you know, open up the door or whatever. So
yeah, there you go. That's the radapult.
I did a radapult. Oh man, that's
congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations to me. So before we wrap up here, I think we'll wrap up soon. Walk me through sort of designing a escape goat puzzle room. I mean, obviously you had certain mechanics that kind of each section of the game explore. But I mean, what's the process of creating like a puzzle section in Escape Goat for you?
So there are a few starting points. The biggest advantage I have is that I put a lot of time into the editor to make it really fast to create and modify levels, because I knew that if it was really painstaking to make levels or to make changes, that I wouldn't want to toss them out if they weren't working. So I wanted it to be as easy as possible to just make like 10 levels, try them out, and keep the 5 ones that were working. And that was pretty much how I made the whole game. There were well over 200 levels made.
I bet.
For the ones that stayed in. And some of them were good, but they just didn't have a place. You know, like there were at least 4 different ones that were like the level where you get the mouse and it teaches you how to use the mouse, stuff like that. And so I just picked the best one. So it's just taking that kind of sketchbook approach of building a lot of stuff and then seeing what sticks. In terms of coming up with puzzle ideas, sometimes I'll work with graph paper and kind of sketch out a little small part of the level and see like how a couple things interact. So I could say, like set up some constraints for the level. Like say this is going to be a level that only uses the bones and the ice blocks. And so what are the things that those two ingredients can do? Well, the bones can, you know, can hold up the ice blocks, except, you know, when an ice block lands on the bones, it'll start to crumble. So you can also push it across. You know, I'll just come up with a small like scene that uses those in some configuration and then see how I can make that into a element of a puzzle and then expand that, maybe do a couple variations on that within the room and then kind of string it together in a sequence, and that would become a whole puzzle room.
Nice. Yeah. Well, and I mean, and it's all, I mean, as we talked about before, it's all kind of done very well. And the learning curve is, I thought was just excellent too. And enjoyable. I mean, it was a pleasure to play and to learn and to kind of have that light bulb, set off in your head when you do figure something out and then go, okay, great. And then you kind of, you apply it on the next level and so on and so forth. But yeah, so super congratulations on Escape Go 2 doing well. I mean, hopefully doing well. Mm-hmm. And obviously the partnership with Double Fine is really, mm-hmm. really great. And hopefully does more good stuff and we see more good stuff come from that and from other developers too. With Double Fine, because that's a great name to have kind of behind your game.
Yes.
But I think your game was deserving as it was, but Double Fine helped it maybe get a little bit more visibility
yeah, absolutely.
In a saturated yeah. market. So
yeah, so you know, before we kind of head out, any you know, news broke recently, of course, about Escape Go 2 coming to the PS4.
Mm-hmm.
Any progress on that? Any possible thoughts about a release date?
Well, we're hoping for summer. We don't really have a firm release date. There's a process, you know, to get the game ported over, and you know, because of the sheer size of Sony, you know, things will move a little bit slower than I don't know, just publishing on Steam, where I could just like, once I've got the app idea, I gotta kind of do whatever I want. Yeah. So it's gonna be a matter of months, and hopefully come out this summer. So we'll kind of see.
Cool,
excellent. Yeah, it looks like it's gonna shape up to be an indie heavy summer on the PS4 after all the games that, you know, they announced.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago.
Yeah, that was a really rad announcement.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but past that, Ian Stalker, of course, the one man Magical Time Bean. Unofficially, anyways, by me, magicaltimebean.com. You can buy Escape Goat 2 or Soulcaster. I think they're all on Humble, right?
And yeah, on Steam, you can buy them all from my website. Escape Goat 1 and 2 are on Steam.
Okay. Yeah, so go buy those. Play them. They're super, super good puzzle platformers. Yeah, super thanks for joining us. This was really fun. And I can't wait to see more stuff from you, and especially I'm definitely going to try out Soulcaster and get myself excited for any kind of news about Soulcaster 3, because it seems like the kind of thing I would enjoy.
Cool, yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no problem. All right.
It was a pleasure.
Goodbye, everybody.